And joining me now is Derek Malia, who is a research assistant professor and atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah. Malia co-created the Great Salt Lake Basin Dust Exposure Modeling Tool, which just launched this month. Derek, thank you so much for being a part of this Green Earth today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk about the Great Salt Lake.
Absolutely. Well, it is a big topic here, and as you just heard, we all know that Abby Ellis created a film here for Sundance. It's called The Lake, and it is a documentary about the Great Salt Lake. It has been a topic of conversation on this program, obviously, quite a few times as we discuss what is happening with the lake and those ripple effects. So I do encourage people to go see that film, The Lake. Abby has been on This Green Earth. But Derek, first, I think let's set the table here and talk about what an atmospheric scientist is and does, and then we'll go into your relationship to the Great Salt Lake and the development of this project. So first, give us a 411 on an atmospheric scientist and the work that you do.
Yeah, so an atmospheric scientist is one that kind of studies the atmosphere and all processes that are related to the atmosphere. Along those lines, too, it's worth noting that we also kind of focus on land-atmosphere interactions as well. So, you know, how does our ground surface, in this case, the lake, how does that kind of interact with the atmosphere? And so, you know, one thing that an atmospheric scientist might study is, you know, how does dust get, you know, emitted into the atmosphere? And then along those lines, how does it get transported downwind? So, you know, of course, we study other things related to climate change, environmental sciences, air quality, air pollution, and then also your traditional kind of meteorologist also falls under the envelope of being considered an atmospheric scientist.
So, Derek, what led you on this path? What was it about learning more about the atmosphere or dispelling this information that was intriguing to you?
Yeah, so I started back on this Great Salt Lake journey way back in 2017 when I was actually a PhD student at the University of Utah. At this time, you know, there were, you know, a lot of, you know, news about the Great Salt Lake at the time. We were seeing, you know, drastically decreasing water levels at around that time. And then at the time, there was also the Bear River Bay project. And there was a lot of concerns about what would that project mean in terms of Great Salt Lake water levels. And so as part of my PhD, I was actually developing a dust model, a dust forecasting model for the state of Utah. And I was actually kind of more focused on other dust sources like, you know, southern Utah or the West Desert. But with all the news about the Great Salt Lake, it got me thinking about, okay, how much dust are we really seeing from this shrinking Great Salt Lake? And, you know, if we go ahead with these water development projects, what would that mean for dust exposure across northern Utah? And so I kind of just, you know, posed the question of, you know, what will dust look like in our future if the lake keeps decreasing? And so that was actually the final chapter of my PhD dissertation, was a very kind of back of the envelope calculation of what that dust exposure would look like just for Salt Lake City. Of course, we've expanded things significantly since then, but that's kind of how I kind of started that journey almost 8 years ago now, which is kind of crazy to think about that. It's been that long now.
Yeah, well, we will get into those ripple effects because we know it will deeply affect, obviously, our state, Salt Lake City, the Wasatch Front area, but it will also ripple out. So we'll get into that in just a moment. But let's first dive into this tool. It's a bit of a mouthful. It's called the Great Salt Lake Basin Dust Exposure Modeling Tool. And you had talked about some of the concerns that you were studying leading you into this. So what led to the creation of this tool? What was it that you were trying to have our communities understand?
Yeah, so, you know, the major objective of this tool was to get something out there for everyone to be able to access and try to get a sense of, you know, what would dust look like in the future. So, you know, when I'm, you know, of course, as scientists, when we're, you know, working on our dissertations, when we're working our PhDs, but also even after the fact, you know, when we're publishing studies, you know, it's still difficult to translate that work to the, you know, the general community, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, we develop these, you know, we write these papers, it goes through the peer review process, And then I feel like it kind of just gets cataloged away. You know, there is a little bit usually of a press release with that stuff getting out in those studies. But along those lines, you know, the science that is done in some ways almost just like kind of disappears, at least from the public view. Not that it really truly disappears. It's just, you know, you would have to actually know where to look for this stuff. So along those lines, we wanted to get something out there that, you know, people can use, but also something that policymakers could also use. And so on. And, you know, the first step about that is, you know, showing a bunch of plots in a paper is not the most effective way to disseminate science, especially with people that are not part of the scientific community. And so for that reason, we wanted to kind of develop this tool so that, you know, it would be easier for policymakers to kind of work with this data and to kind of get a sense of what does different Great Salt Lake water levels actually mean for our dust exposure across northern Utah. And so I think that was actually the ultimate goal of this project or this web page was to develop something that is, you know, more user-friendly than going into a peer-reviewed journal article.
Sure.
Of course, web page is probably not perfect, but at the same time, though, this is an iterative process. And of course, you know, we welcome any feedback. And of course, we'll be refining this tool as time goes on.
Well, you can go to a web page and look at this and understand it yourself. There are graphs, there is data. It is very friendly, I think, to the user. You know, everything when you first roll it out might have a few kinks, but it does get out a lot of information and a greater understanding of what we're up against here. And I think one of the things that is a topic near and dear to our hearts, especially here in Park City with our snowpack levels, is dust does melt our snowpack. So it does have this effect. Can you walk me through research that is done to show that if these dust levels rise, that means it is even a greater risk to our snowpack?
Yeah, so actually, I've done a lot of work, and so this has actually been a lot of work with my colleague, Mackenzie Skiles, and so she's a snow hydrologist. She works actually at the University of Utah in the Department of Geography. So she's actually a snow hydrologist and does those kind of measurements. So actually, we had a project starting in 2019, and that project actually just ended this year. It was a pretty, it was a basically a 6-year project. And so through this collaboration of an atmospheric scientist with a snow hydrologist, we actually found that, you know, dust does get up into our mountains. So especially as you get later in the spring, that, you know, that snow looks darker, looks kind of dirtier. And what you're probably seeing is just, you know, dust from the atmosphere kind of depositing on the snow. And what that does is it actually acts to darken the snow. And so as that snow darkens because of those dust particles, basically what will happen is that will accelerate the snow melt because that dust is basically absorbing more energy from the sun, and then it heats up the surrounding snow, and then that snow then as a result of that melts. And then you get this kind of a feedback process effectively where, you know, the snow starts melting, the dust doesn't evaporate with the snow. And so what happens is those snow or those dust layers start compacting over time, and basically the darkening of the snow basically exponentially kind of almost increases, and the acceleration or the snow melt rate really starts accelerating as you go through the spring. Through this project that I had with Mackenzie, what we actually found is that dust can accelerate snow melt by upwards of 3 weeks, especially in our mountains, and that the Great Salt Lake and especially Farmington Bay dust seems to have a pretty big impact on those snow melt effects.
Well, other things that are deeply, I think, concerning come more to that chemical composition and how it is affecting human health. Can you walk me through how you integrate data regarding these pollutants and what you're finding with that?
Yeah, so basically what we're doing is even though we're doing a pretty good job of this, you know, we can't just remove water from the Great Salt Lake or add it back in for scientific experiments. So one can argue that over the past 10 years, we've been actually doing a pretty good job of that. But along those lines, this modeling framework basically allows us to basically determine the sensitivity of Great Salt Lake dust to different water levels. And so this modeling framework, we take data that was collected by my other colleague, Kevin Perry. So Kevin's been biking around the Great Salt Lake and kind of measuring how easy is it for dust to be kind of emitted from the Great Salt Lake shoreline. And then along those lines, he's also figuring out what parts of the Great Salt Lake are most erodible. And so what he's actually found, that data that he's collected, is that the eastern side of the Great Salt Lake is actually much more erodible than the western side. And the thought here is that probably has to do with the fact that most of our rivers and streams kind of empty into the Great Salt Lake on that eastern side. So you have a lot more kind of loose sediments on that side of the lake. And so that data that he's collected has actually been kind of incorporated with this kind of dust modeling framework. And so we're basically able to map out what parts of the Great Salt Lake are really erodible. And then we have a lake bathymetry data set that basically tells you, you know, what is the elevation of the, you know, the water level? So think of it as like it's measuring like the elevation like inside of a bathtub. In this case, we're looking at the Great Salt Lake. And through this lake bathymetry data set, we're basically able to basically figure out, based on some lake level, what parts of the Great Salt Lake shoreline are going to be exposed. And so from that, we can kind of determine the sensitivity of dust emissions to these different water levels. And then what we do is we actually run a weather model that can kind of basically estimate the transport, or where will that dust kind of transport downwind of the Great Salt Lake. And so all this gets kind of merged into this kind of dust projection tool that we've developed and that's displayed on that webpage.
Right. And when we talk about these contaminants and these pollutants that are being found, like arsenic and different levels of metals and mercury and selenium, what does that look like for the health of those communities?
Yeah. And so, you know, the way that I look at dust is, you know, I think we're still trying to figure out, you know, whether the Great Salt Lake dust actually has high enough concentrations of these heavy metals to actually have health impacts. That's still, I think, a little bit like TBD. We're still trying to figure out, you know, whether those concentrations are actually big enough to result in health impacts. But that said, the big thing with Great Salt Lake dust is that it's still dust, and dust is not good for your air quality. So that's one thing I tell all people. It doesn't matter if the dust is laced with heavy metals or if it's just pure kind of clean, relatively clean mineral dust. It's still not good for your health, because dust has really small, those particles have a really small diameter. And so that allows it to basically penetrate really deep into your lungs. And so that causes all sorts of cardiovascular and respiratory issues. So what I'm getting at with this is that dust, whether it has heavy metals or not, it's just not good for your health regardless. There's no good dust that you want to be breathing in. And dust of all forms has air quality impacts, and therefore health impacts as well.
And as people read this, or even our policymakers or decision makers go on this tool and go around and educate themselves more on what is happening with the water levels, what is the potential for the dust, how do you see this maybe impacting some decisions or how people are absorbing and understanding what we are faced with the Great Salt Lake?
The big thing that I see with this tool is that, you know, because you can kind of change the lake level on this webpage, basically you can get a sense at what Great Salt Lake water levels really reduces the dust exposure. So if you go in that tool and you move the lake levels up and down between the current lake levels that are right now, or you bring it up to the average lake levels, which is going to be around 4,200 feet above sea level, what you'll notice is that the closer you get the lake levels to average, you start seeing a really big reduction in dust exposure for many of the communities across northern Utah, especially on the western side of the Salt Lake Valley, and then also for communities across Ogden and the other communities that are kind of bordering the shoreline of the Great Salt Lake. And you get the biggest reductions in dust exposure when you get those lake levels somewhere around 4,195 feet. So, the higher you get the water levels, the less dust you see. So in some ways, I think that this really helps kind of really confirm that, yeah, getting those lake levels back up to natural levels is really, really important for getting those kind of dust exposure, to get the dust exposure down.
And so this is potentially a solvable situation. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I definitely feel optimistic about it. I think based on what I would hear about the Great Salt Lake, even 5 or 6 years ago, the language has changed substantially from back then compared to now. And I see a lot of kind of positive signs that we are ready to tackle this problem. We still have a ton of work to do. We definitely need to rethink policies. Of course, I'm not a policymaker, so I probably shouldn't comment too much on this. But nonetheless, I think that, a lot of people, and a lot of those policymakers, they do understand that this is a big problem. I think we need to move faster than we are right now. But along those lines, I do see things moving in a positive direction. And so for that reason, I do feel kind of optimistic that we'll figure this out. I feel like it'll probably take longer than we want, but it'll eventually get solved. And so that's maybe my kind of optimistic take on this. But I do want to kind of emphasize that, of course, we still have a lot of work to do. I mean, we're not out of the woods. Lake levels are pretty low right now. But along those lines, I think we are moving in the right direction, maybe a little bit slower than I would like. But I do feel like at some point we will get this problem under control.
And you do cite on here a couple, what you call cautionary tales. And many of us heard about the Salton Sea. I think there was actually even a film in Sundance about the Salton Sea. You talk about Owens Lake. What are the reasons in which you cite these as cautionary tales? What happened there? And why would you like people to understand that that is something that we can move away from?
Yeah, so those are definitely examples of desiccating lakes that they weren't really well dealt with, right? They didn't really do a great job getting water back into those lakes. And so, yeah, those lakes are kind of really prolific kind of emitters of pollution, and they still kind of pollute the air in those communities that are downwind of those lakes. And along those lines, there's definitely a lot of mitigation efforts to kind of reduce dust exposure for those lakes. But along those lines, the state of California, for example, they have to pay a lot of money or spend a lot of money to mitigate the dust for those lakes. And so we kind of want to avoid that. And the good news is with the Great Salt Lake is that once we get the water back into the lake, the dust issues, they will go away. It's a simple kind of science in that if you can get water on top of those our locations that are emitting dust, the dust can no longer get into the atmosphere. And so along those lines, we definitely we don't want this, Great Salt Lake issue to become, first off, really bad for our health, but also along these lines, and a really expensive issue for the state as well. But if we can get water back into the lake, a lot of these problems that we are having or could have, that would be kind of analogous to what's going on with these other lakes in with like Lake Owens and Salton Sea, we can actually largely avoid that. And along those lines too, I do feel more optimistic that, we could solve it just because unfortunately the Great Salt Lake is next to a lot of communities, really all the major communities in Utah. And so for that reason, it's not something that you can just ignore in the state of Utah. So for that reason too, I feel like that maybe it's a little bit of a different story is that, the Great Salt Lake is adjacent to pretty much every major community in Utah. So for that reason, I think that the political willpower to do something about the Great Salt Lake is going to be quite a bit higher than some of those other lakes in California.
Right. I think some of the messaging that I'm hearing also is this urgency because we are dealing with the changing climate. We are dealing with this warming. We're dealing with drought. And it seems like this is happening at a more rapid rate. So the effects of that and the timeline of that, I would think, would really bring this to the top of everyone's mind to say, if this is solvable, it's probably in our best interest to work toward this in a pretty fast and efficient manner.
I 100% agree with this. This is, I think, a very solvable issue. And I think, you know, that's why I feel pretty optimistic about this. Unfortunately, with climate change, you know, that is going to take much, much longer to correct. Probably something that we're not going to see corrected completely in our lifetimes. Along these lines, the Great Salt Lake, because, you know, these changes are happening on such short timescales, this is definitely a solvable problem. And so for that reason, ultimately, this is just a water budget issue. You know, we have a deficit of water going into the Great Salt Lake, and all we need to do is kind of correct this deficit. And it's worth noting that the natural amount of rainfall that we have in Utah, if you look at the 100-year record, it's actually been pretty stable. So it's not that we're seeing a big shift in storm tracks due to climate change or other things that are depleting the lake levels. As things get hotter, you will have more evaporation coming off the lake, but it's not really a first-order effect. The biggest thing that's changing the lake right now is water consumption. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, we can solve. If we had unlimited control, I mean, we could just get all the water back there, back into the lake, and we could fill it in, you know, a couple years. Of course, that's not how things work, but this is definitely something that is much more manageable to work on than, let's say, something like climate change, which is going to take a lot more people involved to solve that problem.
Right. So this is so hopeful to hear that this is solvable, that we are bringing topics up like this, that you are creating these tools that are accessible to everyone so people can go on there and get a visual, because I think this allows for a greater understanding of actually how this has taken place. And there are a lot of educational properties on this website. Can you tell me the website that people can go to? What is it that people can type in and take a look?
If you go to the Wilkes Climate webpage, let me just pull that up really quick. So
I've got it here. I've got wilkescenter.utah.edu. And then where would people go from there?
if they go to the right basically tab, there's actually a tool that says Great Salt Lake. You just click on that, and then you can go to Dust Exposure Tool Story Map and click on that. And then you're good to go. That'll pull up the web page, and that web page will even give you a tutorial about the Great Salt Lake tool, how to use that, and so on.
And the last thing I want to talk about are these things defined as hot spots and how we are, as humans, creating some problems in these fragile areas with some vehicles that are going in these areas and causing a little bit more issue. Can you talk me through these hot spots and why we should avoid them as humans going and disturbing them?
Yeah, so ultimately, what these hotspots are, so if you go to the tool and check out the hotspots, basically these areas kind of denote where the playa crust, so we say the playa, that is basically the soil type of the Great Salt Lake shoreline. That playa crust, kind of like the salt flats out in the, you know, West Desert or the Bonneville Salt Flats, a lot of times there's actually a hard crust. And that hard crust actually does not usually emit dust. It's usually non-emissive and not really there's really not a lot of dust exposure from those that crusted surface. But if that crust starts breaking down, all the stuff underneath that crust is actually very emissive. And so for that reason, if you go on the Great Salt Lake shoreline and you start kind of breaking down that crust, through some type of disturbance, which is, you know, driving vehicles on it. But of course, this crust will also break down just due to just natural kind of wear and tear of the atmosphere, winds, and so on. But the more that that crust breaks down, the more emissive those surfaces can be. So those dust hotspots are just locations where we have where the Great Salt Lake is the most emissive, where it emits the most dust.
Okay, so probably best for us to avoid that and not disturb it, but also to go on to this webpage, wilkescenter.utah.edu, is something we can do that is positive. Take a look at the Great Salt Lake, and you can have more of an education about how these lowering levels of water are affecting us and how this can be, again, a solvable issue. And we should all be paying attention to it. So I really appreciate you, Derek Malia, who is an atmospheric scientist at the University of Utah, who helped develop this tool. It's called the Great Salt Lake Basin Dust Exposure Modeling Tool, and it is a great visual to help us understand what is happening with the Great Salt Lake. Derek, what other things are you working on right now that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, so definitely working on improving this model, basically expanding the sample size of the dust events that we are looking at with this dust exposure tool. So we actually have an update that is in the works right now that will basically expand the sample size of the number of dust events that we look. Having more dust events to look at just gives us more confidence that, you know, the dust exposure tool is, you know, correctly kind of forecasting, you know, what dust exposure might look like. And so that's a big thing that, you know, is coming down the pipeline right now. And so that data should be updated within the next month or two.
Oh, wow.
Long story short, though, the updates actually don't change a whole lot, which is a good thing and a bad thing in the sense, a good thing that, you know, the current version that you have right now, you're not going to see too many changes. But the bad side being, you know, the current version of the model definitely shows that there's quite a bit of dust exposure due to the Great Salt Lake, and that really hasn't changed by increasing the sample size of the dust events that we're looking at. So that's coming down the pipeline right now.
Well, we will make sure that we stay abreast of things that are happening as far as the Great Salt Lake is concerned. So thank you so much, Derek, for giving us a little bit more information about this tool and for bringing this to the public. We appreciate you, and we thank you for coming on This Green Earth.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on this show.
Thanks for listening to This Green Earth. If you have an idea, we'd love to hear from you. Give us your ideas and topics, your storylines. It's thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. You can also find us wherever you listen to your podcast. If you like the show and you learned something new, make sure you leave a review. And we'd appreciate it if you click 5 stars.